Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another installment of our Schmigadoon miniseries, Season 2, Episode 2, Doorway to Nowhere. I am your ginger host, Mackenzie, and after the resounding success of our Season 1 reviews, and now our Season 2, Episode 1 review, it's clear you are all liking these deep dives, so we are going to keep at it. And so we are going to kick things off with a plot summary. So, this episode picks up with Josh in prison. The narrator is giving snippy commentary on Josh's situation, and there's a whole question of whether or not the narrator, is an omniscient figure or not. Sergeant Rivera then brings in Topher, Danny Bailey from last season, who is now a hippie who wants to find his purpose in life. In the meantime, Melissa seeks out and hires Bobby Flanagan, Countess Gabrielle von Blurkum, last season, as Josh's lawyer. Bobby lays out her plan for Josh and suggests Melissa go undercover as a dancer at the cabaret club, the Krat Club, to find the real killer. After an audition process reminiscent of a chorus line, Melissa, despite not being as skinny or as skillful a dancer as the other girls, is selected for the part club owner Octavius Krat. As Jenny Banks congratulates Melissa, she proposes that they become roommates as Elsie will not be needing the room or her clothes anymore. Josh's press conference with Bobby ends in disaster after he goes off script that Bobby had prepared, stating that Josh murdered Elsie due to the influence of jazz music and liquor. With Josh's denial, the press declares he is guilty and will get the chair, which they apparently use more frequently than one would think. Melissa moves into her new lodgings with Jenny and finds out Elsie was having a secret relationship with Mr. Krat. And now that Elsie is dead, Jenny has taken up the relationship in her place. Sergeant Rivera comes by to drop off flowers and an outfit for Jenny to wear to her date with Mr. Krat. While Jenny does her quick change, Sergeant Rivera warns Melissa to not go poking around, and Jenny then departs for her date and informs Melissa that she knows the situation with Mr. Krat is not ideal, but she's doing it to survive. Melissa then has her opening night where she performs the number Bustin' Out with Jenny and the MC. As Melissa performs, Josh is back at the prison and is depressed when suddenly Topher's hippie friends burst in and bust him out of prison along with Topher, and they escape on the happiness bus, which Josh thought was a metaphorical device, not an actual bus. After her performance, Melissa and the dancers celebrate her opening night success, and Madame Frau, who runs the cabaret dances, gives Melissa Elsie's old dressing room. Melissa peruses the room for clues and finds an uneaten box of chocolates Mr. Krat was carrying backstage on the night of the murder, and a note that shows Elsie had a standing meeting on Sundays at 17 Quick Street. As the episode ends, Jenny tells Melissa not to go slumming around Quick Street, and police sirens are heard as Josh continues his getaway in the happiness bus. Bum, bum. So there we go. Lots happening in this episode. Lots of good individual scenes as well. We'll do our Melissa and Josh check-in as well. So, picking up where we left off with Josh and Melissa, we have Josh once again going into Schmigadoon with a practical plan of, we'll go in, we'll have a good time, we'll get rejuvenated, and then we'll leave. Melissa thinking that she'll find that golden age idealistic musical setting again to kind of get her idealism energy back, and they find it's not the case. And then here we have kind of the same setup as last season, where Josh and Melissa venture on their own storylines, but unlike last season, where their storylines were brought about due to conflict with each other, this time they are united in the common goal of obtaining Josh's innocence, which shows the progression from last season that Josh and Melissa have found their true love partner and that they are still on the same page, even though they haven't quite found their happy ending yet. On the Josh front, Josh is confronted by the results of his practicality, where just because he expressed his innocence adamantly, he doesn't understand that part of a trial, for better or worse, is the salesmanship. And that means telling a compelling story to the media, to the press, to the court, to sway their opinions. And, you know, this is kind of, once again, Chicago is all about holding the mirror up to our judicial system. And once again, this show is doing the same thing where the person with the best story is not always the innocent party, but can usually spin a good tale. So it's one of those things where, you know, Josh, once again, being a BIPOC man in prison who is going to be executed for a crime he did not commit, there definitely is some serious undertones. And the fact that, once again, his practicality gets in his way a bit, where he knows he's innocent, he's professing his innocence, but people are just not listening and are only looking for the good story. And so Josh realizes that this practical planning that he's doing isn't always going to be the proper solution. Sometimes you do have to get a little creative, get a little bit of that idealistic, hopeful energy, and kind of just embrace that side of you, that it, that kind of goes with the flow a bit, that it doesn't always have a perfect plan, you know? And so it's interesting. Like, once Josh gets on the happiness bus, right away he is opened up a bit. Like, we see him singing at the end of the episode, which, you know, we never didn't see Josh sing till the very end of last season. So the fact that he's opening himself up this way really does kind of show that he does have this side within him, but once again, his practical side can sometimes get in his way a bit. So that's great. And also the fact that, once again, he's paired up with Topher, who is an idealist, who is searching for that, well, for better we'll have a corner of the sky, you know, looking for that idealistic future of peace and love. And then you have Josh, who calls him out, kind of says, you're a good-looking, relatively young white guy, you know, with good hair. Like, you're going to be A-okay. You're going to find your spot. Don't you worry about it, you know? So it's one of those things where, you know, you kind of have Josh, once again, practical side coming out, his cynicism coming out at the world, when in this situation, you kind of need to kind of embrace the ridiculous, the less practical side of this world in order to kind of get through it. So it's one of those things where Josh kind of has to continue to learn this lesson. He hasn't quite matched it all yet. So it all kind of is a nice commentary there for Josh. On the Melissa front, she's kind of doing this really unique floating between the practical world and the ideal world, where she starts the episode from a practical spot, hiring Josh, the best lawyer in town, for a, well, with Sawbuck, which is $10, but she gives him a $20. So, you know, it's one of those things where she pays double and gets a good deal for that. And then she reluctantly goes into the ideal world by auditioning for a spot at the club. I mean, she says, I'm a double threat, not a triple threat, meaning she was never good at dance. She openly admits that she doesn't have the ideal body type that is shown in this world, but she does have these aspirations, these dreams of, you know, performing and being involved in this musical world. So then we see her at this audition, and as the audition comes along, she lets loose and has her most genuine moment of her audition when she has her solo, her magic in the mirror, that moment in the mirror moment from Chorus Line kind of moment, where she says, I'm a doctor and a doctor doctors, and how she feels that, like, every time she delivers a baby, she wishes it was her. And it's a really beautiful, genuine moment. I mean, Cicely Strong can sing, man. She has a beautiful singing voice. And so it's a really kind of neat thing where she, once again, she has this practical side she's fighting with, where she is constantly floating between the two. And even then, her idealists sometimes blind her a bit to the realization that Kratt is the one that kind of got her the job simply because he likes her. She hasn't quite put that piece together. We're kind of ahead of her as an audience on this front. But it's one of these great things. And then, you know, she's kind of on this practical streak at the end of the episode where she's clue hunting and everything else. And Josh, meanwhile, is escaping from prison to go out and find that happiness that he's kind of been lacking. So it's a very interesting spot we find these two characters in. Next, we have our cast shoutouts. So our cast shoutout of the episode goes to Aaron Tveit, who gets introduced as Topher after he played the role of Danny Bailey last season, kind of the Billy Bigelow type. But this time he's playing Topher, who's a bit of a amalgamation of Pippin and Jesus from Godspell. And, you know, we get some hair vibes in there too. It's just kind of this great amalgamation. And one of the things that it shows is Aaron has this comedic side to him that we don't get to see because he's usually playing serious roles like Enjolras in Les Mis, or, you know, he's in Moulin Rouge playing the romantic male lead, Catch Me If You Can, all these roles that really have some comedic moments, but nothing that's like this where it's just full comedy. So it was just such a wonderful welcome surprise, and that's why he gets the cast shout out this episode, because he is just wonderful in this role, where you kind of just go, oh my goodness, there's this whole other side to you that who knew you had it in you. So it's really great, and he really does a good job with his character motivation of trying to find his life's ambition. It's very relatable and reflects why these 70s youth characters related so well to the younger audiences of that era, because they also were searching for their purpose because the Vietnam War wasn't it for them due to the fact they didn't believe in it. And, you know, it's one of those things where the older generation, the generation previous, the baby pre-baby boomers, the World War II generation, had a war they fought and believed in. Now you have this Vietnam War that they didn't believe in, and they were fighting, and so they weren't going to have that same attraction to that purpose in life. So that's why when you look at the 70s and the civil rights and the civil unrest and all these protests, because people were trying to find what their purpose was. And I think Aaron really does fit that mold of a character, and it's really wonderful. And I'm excited to see what his arc is going to be this season. Is he going to stay the kind of goofy dolt, good-hearted guy, or is he going to find that purpose? Is he going to find that doorway to wear? Very interesting. Very, very interesting. All right, let's get into some songs. So we have the first song of the episode, which is Doorway to Wear. Poets sing of starlight, kittens play with string. Why does it seem I'll never find my thing? Squirrels find nuts in the forest. Okay. Robins fly high in the air. What am I supposed to be? Who is this guy called me? When will I see my doorway to wear? It's clearly a take on the I Want song from Pippin, Corner of the Sky, even down to the kind of the rolling piano and kind of the phrasing is very similar. Cats fit on the windowsill, children fit in the snow. So why do I feel I don't fit in anywhere I go? Rivers belong where they can ramble. Eagles belong where they can fly. I've got to be where my spirit can run free. Gotta find my corner of the sky. Interesting, lyrically, both of Aaron's big solo songs each season reference squirrels. In You Can't Tame Me from last season, Danny Bailey kind of sings about when a squirrel wants another squirrel, there's bound to get a pat. You know, and they talk about how a squirrel kind of goes for it. And here, you're getting another squirrel reference again, where it's kind of just, you know, a squirrel's going to do its thing. It's going to need a nut, that type of thing there. So it's kind of funny that both Aaron's songs feature squirrels. Yeah, I mean, Aaron, who I'm surprised has never played Pippin before, or somebody from Godspell or Hair, because he would fit those musicals great. But Aaron sings this song with such sincerity, and you feel the struggle of him wanting to find his way of conforming into this society, but just not finding that way. Like, he talks about how socks fit perfectly in a drawer, how cats like to play with yarn, how there's this expectation that these things will fall into place, and for him it's just not there. And so he's really doing a good job of playing at the sincerity of the song, which is what it makes him such an endearing cellmate for Josh. And I mean, the simplicity of the lyrics is a great reflection of the simple, non-complex way that Topher views the world, where he thinks everyone should just have peace and love. And, you know, that's the reflection of the idealistic battle of the 1970s with the hippie movement versus the rigid views of, you know, conservative cookie-cutter society that they were fighting against. So once again, it's a great kind of parallel reflection of what these musicals were doing at this time. So it's a really good job there. The next song we have is I Need to Eat, which is a hilarious take on a Chorus Line's catalog of songs with references to the opening number, God, I Hope I Get It, mixed with references to At the Ballet with one of the monologues about the dancer who danced to drown in her parents' fights. Then there's the music in The Mirror, which is the big Cassie solo in Chorus Line and with Melissa's heartfelt confession of wanting her ideal family life. There's a good parallel there. I love that we've done an episode on Fosse choreography in the first episode, and now we're getting full-on Michael Bennett style choreography with this episode, with the audition. It's really great. And then you have Inharada as the kind of the audition master person there, who's leading the audition, similar to what we have in a Chorus Line, who's kind of the director voice who's auditioning the chorus members. And she's also got a bit of a Madame Giry energy too for Phantom of the Opera, with that kind of beat cane she does to beat it, nail at the beats as well. And just her side takes with all the auditionees is great. And her just shouting in German at them is hysterical. I thoroughly enjoyed that aspect of the scene. At the end, there's a great orchestral vamp that happens when everybody's putting their headshots up in front of them, a la Chorus Line. And then, of course, Melissa doesn't realize that's what they're doing, so she has to get her driver's license ID, but it takes her a minute. So it's great how they orchestrally have this vamp that gets more and more exasperated with her as it takes her longer and longer to get the ID out to meet to be in place of her headshot, which is really funny. And then we have a interesting little small song, which is Here Comes Bobby, which is sung by the prisoners as Bobby Flanagan makes her appearance in the jail. There's not a ton of notes I have for this song because it's really a chorus with Bobby talking to Josh. But, you know, it's a very clear vamp on the opening part of the song All I Care About Is Love from Chicago, which is the chorus prisoner female singing, he's a kind of a guy. You know, and then because Bobby's name is Bobby, we, of course, get the company reference of, you know, the Bobby baby, Bobby booby, Robert, Robert darling. So it's a great kind of combo of those two vamps from those classic musicals. And another interesting thing here is just how Aaron Tveit's Topher song featured the reappearance of squirrels. In this scene, we have Bobby Flanagan talk about how part of winning the case is all about flapdoodle. And this is the second time that's come up because Kristen Chenoweth used that word in her Trials and Tribulations song last season. So interesting choice that we're getting some repeat wordplay here. And then, of course, we have the big number of the episode, Bustin' Out. This song is very clearly in the style of You Could Drive a Person Crazy from Sondheim's Company, which itself was inspired by the Andrews Sisters, but this is the song that the three girlfriends of Bobby sing, all about how he's kind of not relatable to them, how he kind of is a cold fish sometimes, is a bit aloof. You could drive a person crazy. You could drive a person mad, do-do-do-do-do. You know that type of thing there. And, you know, it's really kind of funny how, once again, this song is paired off with Josh's actual escape. And even the lyrics are reflecting Josh's escape as well. And it's a really kind of interesting way of reflecting on this time period of musical theater songs, that there are musical numbers that sometimes narrate the obvious actions that are taking place on stage, because the gritty, more realistic, naturalistic stories didn't give as many opportunities for straightforwardly entertaining numbers. So the writers of the period, particularly Kander and Ebb, started using showy, old-school numbers that were thoughtfully written lyrics to ironically comment on the plot. So, you know, just like how in Sally Bowles is having her mental breakdown singing, life is a cabaret, old chum. It's that same type of vibe there. Orchestrally, you can also hear musical riffs on the Chicago Overture. And then, for me, I just love the choreography of this number where you have Melissa and Jenny and the MC all linked together by an ankle chain. So the choreography of that, just getting them to line up right and do all that, and then when they have their own handcuffs on their hands and they're doing cane work, it was very well choreographed. I thoroughly enjoyed that. All right, let's round this out with some fun Easter eggs here before we get into final thoughts. So my first note is obviously Aaron Tveit's role as Topher is a mix, as I said, of Pippin, Godspell, and Hare leads. It's kind of a amalgamation of all those characters in the prison. One of the prisoners' name is Conrad. He's in this kind of gold suit. Isn't Topher supposedly touching a girl? This is clearly parodies Conrad Birdie from Bye Bye Birdie. Then we have Jane Krakowski's Bobby Flanagan, clearly a take on Billy Flynn from Chicago. Plus, the name is clearly an homage to how in the recent revival of Company, the lead role of Bobby was gender bent from Bobby with a Y to Bobby with an IE. Now, in this, the subtitles still show it as a Y, but it's clearly a reference to how they've gender bent Company in more recent revivals. Then the other big character that kind of gets shown finally is Jamie Camille's Sergeant Rivera, which I have to assume is a riff on Cheetah Rivera, the wonderful actress herself. But clearly the role of Sergeant Rivera has roots in the role of Beetle Bamford from Sweeney Todd, who's the right-handed Judge Turpin, and just like this, Sergeant Rivera is the nephew and enforcer of Mr. Kratt. So there's a great kind of setup there. We'll see how evil he is, or if he does have a softer side, because it does seem like he does, because he has that great conversation with Melissa. And, you know, there's a bit of a old energy there to them, because they were lovers last season. Now they're kind of dueling it out with each other a bit, so it's really great. So with Bobby's introduction monologue in her law office, she has this monologue where she kind of sets herself up, talks about her degree and everything else, and it's clearly based off the monologue from the song Roxy from Chicago. There's even a line referencing of a world full of no. So there's a great kind of stuff there. Also in Bobby's office, there's a framed newspaper that reads, "Prosecution frazzles, Bobby dazzles," a reference to Billy Flynn's Razzle Dazzle Chicago song. Then when Melissa goes to her audition at the Kratt Club, she has an outfit that is very reminiscent of Fanny from Funny Girl. And even with her bad dancing, taking out all the other auditionees at the end, clearly a reference there. One of the dancers who auditions in the song gives a monologue that it turns out to be the life story of Liesl von Trapp, where, as we know, in The Sound of Music, there's the So Long Farewell song, and Liesl asks to taste her first champagne, and her dad says no, but apparently later on that night, the Baroness, once again, very, very mean to the Baroness. She's a very complex character. Did give her that taste of champagne, and ultimately she took the whole bottle, and now she's gone down a much darker path in life, and, you know, now she's kind of working in nightclubs, so there's some tragedy there. And as I said, there's the whole ending in the song I Need to Eat, where they all hold up headshots. This is clearly a homage to how the God, I Hope I Get It number ends in a chorus line, so there's that. As well, the press conference with Josh and Bobby is clearly a reference to the number We Both Reached for the Gun from Chicago, right down to the accusation that it was jazz and liquor that was the motive for the murder. It wasn't her, it was the jazz and the liquor. And the last kind of big Easter egg we have here is all about the clue that Melissa finds, saying there's going to be a meeting on Quick Street on Sunday. And at the end of the episode, there's a reference. I mean, this is clearly a reference to how in the musical Annie, there's a song called Easy Street. And we know that Kristen Chenoweth's character is a play on Miss Hannigan from that show. And then it's also a play on the Fleet Street title from Sweeney Todd. And we know that Alan Cumming's character is a butcher who is reminiscent of Sweeney Todd. So there's a good setup there, Quick Street, setting up where this world's going to lead. So very good setup there. All right, final thoughts of the episode. So the first two episodes came out as a pair, and as I said, I split them up because I wanted to have more time to digest the episodes and not rush them out. These are a perfect pair to set up the season, and I'm very excited for episode 3. And watching the episode 1 and 2 together just made me wish that both these episodes were 40 minutes long, because I feel like you could have taken the first episode, made that into one longer 40-minute episode, and then done a whole other 40-minute episode for episode 2. Because it's just one of those things where you watch it and these episodes move at a really breakneck speed where the story is moving fast. And I feel like if we had more than 6 episodes, maybe 10 or 12, and had a longer runtime for each episode, you could really kind of let the world sink in, like really have like a fun number, like maybe Josh is in prison and does like a cell block tango style number with Topher and the other prisoners. You know, we could have more, we could have a both reach for the gun style number with the press conference there, and just, you know, embrace some other musicals of the period, like get even doing like a you're always sorry, you're always grateful type number between Josh and Melissa, as like they're having a tough time with him in prison. You know, there's so many other opportunities to put in more songs and more moments to build these characters out further. It's just such a tragedy that this show is only 6 episodes and is only 30 minutes per episode. I just wish it was longer. I will say though, this is a great introduction to Jane and Aaron's characters. They make great first appearances in the episode, and I look forward to seeing them evolve over the season. Even Dove Cameron gets another great moment in this episode. I mean, we gave her a shout out last episode for her kaput number and her character introduction, which was terrific. But Dove has a really sincere moment here about her character knowing that her relationship with Mr. Kratt is wrong and in so many ways not good for her. But at the same time, this is the world she lives in. She has to survive any way she can. And so Dove really does drop into a very serious, sincere, dramatic moment. She's talking to Melissa about this, and it's really well done. So shout out to that. I also like how in Josh and Melissa's relationship in this episode, we're already seeing the evolution of who these characters were from last season, where Josh is willing to embrace some of that more idealistic side, where Melissa is taking on the practical world of, you know, fighting for her husband's innocence. Kind of getting a bit of a parade vibe here, where Melissa's taking on the Lucille Frank role to Josh's Leo Frank situation there. But that's a 90s musical, so we're not there yet. And then, once again, Titus Burgess, as the narrator, is just so fun as that kind of omniscient, it's the omniscient narrator, where, you know, he's sassing Josh all the time. Melissa even says to ignore him at some points because he gets annoying. And, you know, it's a really well done dynamic there. And just the fact that he does give some questionable looks where, you know, it's kind of like, ooh, is this guy safe? Are we okay with him, or is he leading Josh astray by helping him escape from prison? Who knows? We'll have to see. And the last thing is, I love how this season is embracing some of the more ridiculous aspects of the musical styling here, where, you know, Topher keeps trying to make this situation all about him. He's trying to have all these reprises of Doorway to Where, and Josh and Melissa keep shutting him down. It's a really kind of great thing, and how the underscore begins to swell when he tries to start singing, and then the minute Josh wants to stop it, it then becomes a bit of a clang on the piano. It's a great kind of fun bit there too. So overall, great first 2 episodes, great for second episode. Just wish we had more time and more area in the world just to dive in deeper. So lots of fun. All right, everybody, thanks so much for tuning in, and we will see you all in episode 3. All right, have a great rest of your day. Stay healthy, stay safe. We're busting out. Boom, 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 busting out.